read and comment very briefly about certain periods in English literature, ranging from particularly the late 16th century through to the late 19th century, covering about three centuries of English poetry. And briefly, going back for just a brief moment to the 14th century, to Chaucer, just to show you something of the changes in the language from that earlier time to the present. I've selected first just a very short section from the prologue to Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, section dealing with the man of religion. It's a rather interesting comment because it does suggest the seriousness and the authenticity of some of the religious people during that particular period, describing both types, of course. In his writings, at least we might suppose there were some very sincere people, like the person of the town referred to in this little section. A good man was there of religion, and was a poor person of a town, but rich he was of holy thought and work. He was also a learned man, a clerk, that Christ's gospel truly wold the preacher, his parishioners devoutly wold he teach. Benign he was, and wonder diligent, and in adversity full patient, and such he was, he craved oft to see this, full loath were him to coursen for his tears, but rather wold he yeven aught of doubt unto his poor apparitions abode, of his offering and ache of his substance, he could in little thing have so peace. Where he comments on this generosity of the man, giving of his what he had, even though he was not at all well off, serving the poor and serving as an example to the people within his parish. At other times he criticizes some for and not being the kind of people they should have been in the positions which they held. You can see that the problem in the language is really not so great, except for a few words in that little passage. Most of the other words, especially if you look at them on the page, you can make them out. And there's not really much real need to read in translation or in a newer modern version the Canterbury Tales. With a little effort, you can really get back to the times, even though it is back into the 14th century. This next probably dates from about the 15th century. It's one of the ballads written in the period of the 15th century, possibly a little before. A very famous one, many of you may be familiar with it, Sir Patrick Spence. It's very well written in terms of poetic form. You have more sense of carefulness and of avoidance of any excess words or statements within the ballad. Every word seems to count. It's a good example of folk poetry written with rather unusual precision for the manner in which many of these ballads usually were written. There are many theories on how ballads were actually made up, some suggestions being that each person at a wedding or a festival of some kind added a line, and another added and added. It was pretty cooperative involvement to write the final poem. And then considering they've passed through so many versions to the present, usually they end up in a rather choppy form, not very literally accurate. But this Sir Patrick Spence in his ballad form is almost perfect. It's often singled out as the greatest ballad of English literature. The background for this is rather interesting in terms of the times. Supposedly it's based upon an actual figure in the past who was ordered by his king to take a group of the lords in passage between England and Ireland, and in the difficulty, the ship sunk, Sir Patrick died with all of his men. But also there's the ironic conclusion to this particular ballad that as well the lords that were on the ship also went down with him. So there's some ironic satisfaction in Sir Patrick Spence's position and death. The ballad stanza usually has just a pair of rhymes, so it's not as complex as far as forcing the poet to have rhymes easily to hand, and the rhythm is also very simple. The king sits in Dunfermline town, drinking the blood-red wine. Oh, where will I get good sailor to sail the ship of mine? Open spak an elden knicht, sat at the king's richt knee. Sir Patrick Spence is the best sailor that sails upon the sea. The king has written a brave letter and signed it with his hand, and sent it to Sir Patrick Spence, was walking on the sand. The first line that Sir Patrick read, a loud laugh clouted hay. The next line that Sir Patrick read, the tear blinded his ee. Oh, why is this as done this deed, this ill deed done to me, to send me out this time of the year to sail upon the sea? Mak haste, my merry men all, our good ship sails the morn. O then I say, my master dear, for I fear a deadly storm. Late, late yestreen I saw the new moon with the old moon in his arm. And I fear, my dear master, that we will come to harm. Oh, our Scots nobles were richt lathe to wet their cork-heeled shoon. But long o'er all the play were play, their hats they swam aboon. Oh, long, long may their laddies sit with their fans into their hand, for ere they see Sir Patrick Spence come sailing to the land. Oh, long, long may the ladies stand with their gold kems in their hair, waiting for their ain dear lords, for they'll see them na mair. Half o'er to Aberdour, it's 50 fathom deep, and there lies good Sir Patrick Spence with the Scots lords at his fate. Concludes with this ironic idea that the Scots lords also have died in his passage over to Redditizer in Scotland, Aberdour. He knows understatement and subtlety, complexity, and compression, some of the qualities that you usually associate with very sophisticated later poetry. And yet this anonymous writer or writers back in the 15th century, possibly before, were quite aware of devices that they might use to make the poem more interesting and more haunting in its ways than otherwise. It was to the use of the mysterious, the superstitious, in reference to the moon having the other moon within it in a strange way, at least as appeared to the person reacting to the request that they should go out into the storm. So there is poetic justice, in a sense, for the king's lords having died, as they may even suggest a democratic attitude and reaction to the royalty here of this Sir Patrick Spence, at least wasn't in very much agreement with the leaders of government at that time. Jumping from then, the 15th century, to the late 16th, I'd like to turn to a poem of Sir Philip Sidney, that many thought of as the perfect courtier of the late 16th century. This is from one of his sonnets, from a sonnet series called Astrophel and Stella, describing the problem of a lover, not necessarily Sir Philip Sidney, because these writers often wrote for other imagined characters who were having the thoughts or voicing the views in the poem. You can't associate the poems very readily with the writers themselves. In this case, the writer suggests through the poem, as he comes to the conclusion of it, the idea that being honest and sincere is what is needed in love, not being artificial and clever and having the kind of line that appeals to a lover. This is a short sonnet. Loving in truth, in feign in verse my love to show, that she, dear she, might take some pleasure of my pain. Pleasure might cause her read. Reading might make her know. Knowledge might pity win. and pity grace obtain. I sought fit words to paint the blackest face of woe. Studying inventions fine for wits to entertain, oft turning others' leaves to see if thence would flow some fresh and fruitful showers upon my sunburned brain. But words came halting forth, wanting invention stay. Invention, nature's child, fled stepdame study's blows, and others' feet still seem but strangers in my way. Thus, great with child to speak, and helpless in my throes, biting my truant pen, beating myself for spite. Fool, said my muse to me, look in thy heart and write. Suggesting here the answer to the problem that's presented in the first part of the sonnet here, the regular form of the sonnet as it had been used in Italy before by Petrarch and Italian poets, and then imitated by English poets in this same period of the Renaissance. You can see a lot of the devices of the poet practiced here, particularly personification. Pleasure, for example, causing her to read. Pleasure as a person, as a personified idea of pleasure. Knowledge as a person, my pity win, pity grace obtain, which these abstractions are referred to as the persons in the poem, and later nature's child, or study's blows. You see, a way of trying to compress thought into a short space by the use of this poetic device that many poets, particularly in this age, use, though it isn't very common at all today. Modern poets rather shun the device. Competition between the poets in writing in certain forms was very common in the age. And to be able to write a sonnet as one equal to one of Shakespeare's or Sidney's or Spencer's or another was the constant desire of the courtiers. And often they would write for themselves, not necessarily writing for the public, because in this particular age, printing presses were not in great number. And there wasn't a real market for the purchase of this poetry as such until a little later time. But they wrote nevertheless, and eventually, as the century progressed and through into the early 17th century, more printing took place, and these poems were collected and then published at that time. The next writer I'd like to turn to is Michael Drayton, writing in about the same time as the previous poet. This is another sonnet. This too, dealing with the problem of love relationship or human relationship. Notice how the change occurs in the last part of the poem as he shifts to a somewhat different mood of continued hopefulness that perhaps the love will not break, will not cause them to have to separate. Since there is no help, come, let us kiss and part. Nay, I have done. You get no more of me. And I am glad, yea, glad with all my heart, that thus so cleanly I myself can free. Shake hands forever. Cancel all our vows. And when we meet at any time again, be it not seen in either of our brows that we one jot of former love retain. Now, at the last gasp of love's latest breath, when his pulse failing, passion speechless lies, when faith is kneeling by his bed of death, and innocence closing up his eyes, now if thou wouldst, when all hath given him over, from death to life, thou mightst him yet recover. This last hope comes through here at the last line. Even though all of these things seem to have failed, as in the case of most lovers making this parting, they often wish that perhaps things hadn't reached the point where the break has to come, as this desire that perhaps they might suddenly go back to where they had been before the break. Just one sonnet of Shakespeare, since we've had several others in this form to show an expression here of extreme love, of true love. This was a convention in the times, and you find the poets writing on either side of the view of either fickle love or true love in extremes. And here is one of the strong true love sonnets of Shakespeare. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often it is gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometimes declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. Fine statement here at the end of how this particular sonnet read now still continues to commemorate the love or friendship which is spoken of in the first part of the sonnet. It's very difficult to be sure whether the person addressed in the poem is often a man or a woman. You can see how in this case you certainly would think it would be a statement addressed to a woman. There are various views and ideas, some of which suggest there references this to a strong friendship between two men, that their relationship too might be commemorated in some of the same ways. You have certain ambiguity in many of these sonnets. It's difficult to be quite certain about, and whether Shakespeare is writing these sonnets for friends, for other friends, or whether they're written personally for himself, there's no way of ever being sure about the matter now. In some ways it makes them more interesting because of the puzzle regarding the relationship in them. This next poet is one who has most strongly influenced modern poets, John Donne. I selected just two of his poems here to show certain characteristics of his poetry, which is highly compressed and difficult sometimes in the fact that he strove after very complex ideas, what were called at that time metaphysical conceits or conceptions, in which the words were somewhat complexly related to each other. It's a little hard to grasp immediately in the reading because some of this takes re-examination and re-looking at to really appreciate the beauty of the word choices and the relationship of the parts of the poem. This is from the poem The Valediction Forbidding Mourning, which expresses the idea of perfect love, the kind that you have in Shakespeare's sonnet. And Edward Donne is almost a contemporary of Shakespeare. So he too is writing about the same general themes that were written about by others, but in a very different way, in a very imaginative way. The Valediction Forbidding Mourning by John Donne. As virtuous men pass mildly away, and whisper to their souls to go, while some of their sad friends do say the breath goes now, and some say no, so let us melt and make no noise. No tear floods nor sigh tempests move, for profanation of our joys to tell the laity of our love. Moving of the earth brings harms and fears. Men reckoned what it did and meant, but trepidation of the spheres, though greater far, is innocent. Dull sublunary lovers love, whose soul is sense, cannot admit absence, because it doth remove those things which elemented it. But we, by a love, so much refined that our senses know not what it is, interassured of the mind, care less, eyes, lips and hands to miss. Our two souls, therefore, which are one, though I must go, endure not yet a breach, but an expansion like gold to airy thinness beat. If they be two, They are two so as stiff twin compasses are two. Thy soul, the fixed foot, makes no show to move, but doth it the other do. And though it in the center sit, yet when the other far doth roam, it leans and hearkens after it, and grows erect as that comes home. Such wilt thou be to me, who must like the other foot obliquely run. Thy firmness makes my circle just, and makes me end where I have begun. A little explanation here will show you the keenness of his thought, particularly in the last part, where he talks about dull sublunary lover's love, his earthly love, whose soul is sense, who only think in terms of material or physical relationship. This kind of love, he says, cannot admit absence. The lovers of this kind are separate, they're lost, and they're in great pain. But if the lovers are also bound spiritually, then even though the other is separated from the love, there's a bond and a tie between the two that gives some satisfaction, some meaningfulness, even to themselves in absence. Many feel this poem was written at a time when Donne, who had to separate himself from his wife, had to go on business on the continent. And he wrote this to assure her of the kind of love, or describe the kind of love that he felt they should have for each other. In the next stanza, he comments, but we by a love so much refined that ourselves know not what it is, interassured of the mind, care less eyes, lips, and hands to miss. We can miss the separation, the touching of hands and relationship to it in a physical sense. Then he describes their souls as but an expansion like gold to airy thinness beat. Often the engravers at this time, working with gold, found that a very small amount of gold, when beaten, would spread out and cover a very large area. It was an unusual metal, and one that was excellent to work with because of its malleability. So he's thinking here in terms of the fact that though there's just a small bit there, it spreads, and if they're far apart, they're still in some way, as in this image, an idea they're associating together, even though separate and spread out as gold to airy thinness might be when beaten. And then his best image, best conceit here at the end, if they be but two, they are two so as stiff twin compasses are two. The compasses, each leg of the compass would be called a compass. So as the compass would be used and put on the paper and the circle were made and turned, the center point, too, would lean with the outer one to a degree, so that there'd be a relationship of mutual action between the two. If they were so bound together as souls, that when the one felt one way, the other would feel the same way in himself. So the one moves with the other, even when they're separate, that they're that bound together in this spiritual love that he's describing here between himself and, with the narrator, between himself and his love for her love. And then, when the last part he closes, it leans and hearkens after it and grows erect as that comes home. And usually when the compass would be used at that time, it closed the compass. It would be closed together and then placed down. So it wouldn't, they'd have this closeness bond between the sympathy at the end. And the last part he comments about how the circle is just as the one is faithful to the other, so the circle is perfect. You move the center point a little, the circle becomes untrue and unperfect. The circle is thought of as a symbol of perfection also in eternity. So you get this idea also brought into the poem at that point. So you get the kind of intellectual keenness and imaginativeness that the modern poet often is driven for in his writing as well. And Donne is greatly appreciated, being one of the keenest of imaginative poets of all time. So that T.S. Eliot and those who were influenced by Eliot in the 20s and 30s went back very much to Donne, and a great interest in restudying his poetry and republishing it came in the periods of the 20s and the 30s, and still today. But you can see it's not a simple poem at first, especially if you're not familiar with some of the things alluded to in the writings. It's one difficulty with Donne. This next is a sonnet by Donne, which is one of the holy sonnets. Donne became, and many have considered him, the greatest preacher ever to have preached in the Anglican Church. He was a preacher at St. Paul's, and many of the Englishmen came to that particular congregation because his sermons were so outstandingly powerful and effective. And this holy sonnet, 7, is from a collection he wrote principally upon religious subject matter. The reference to the earth's imagined corners here relates to the ideas about through revelation as interpreted at that time. I use them somewhat literally here. It doesn't mean that Donne was a literalist in terms of his beliefs, but he does make use of revelation here in the references in this particular sonnet. He's speaking about death in the last days here. Yes, in terms of his own self. Many think it's a very personal poem, too. And most of his religious devotions are very personal, so it's possible or probable that it's written very much for himself. He's not thinking here in terms of some other narrator and presenting a view of that other person. He writes, "At the round earth's imagined corners, blow your trumpets, angels, and arise. Arise from death, you numberless infinities of souls, and to your scattered bodies go, all whom the flood did and fire shall o'erthrow, all whom war, dearth, age, agues, tyrannies, despair, law, chance hath slain, and you whose eyes shall behold God and never taste death's woe. But let them sleep, Lord, and me mourn a space. For if above all these my sins abound, 'tis late to ask abundance of thy grace when we are there. Here, on this lowly ground, teach me how to repent. For that's as good as if thou hadst sealed my pardon with thy blood." Where he first asks for the end of the world to come in the time that he's writing this poem, and then asks for delay, feeling himself not ready yet for the judgment to come upon him, feeling that perhaps in his heart he isn't really repentant. And he asks and prays here for God at the end to teach me how to repent, seeing that if in this repentance he would feel secure in the pardon of Christ of his sins, according to the beliefs held often in the Anglican Church at that time. But you can see how he builds up to a high point in the first 8 lines, the last 6 lines. You get this slight shift, closing with a very personal series of lines, 2.5 lines, in which he makes this personal appeal to God in terms of his feeling about his own relationship to God at that point. Again, very perfectly drawn, pulled together here in terms of imagery and with a dramatic thrust at the end. His use of language is very different than many of his contemporaries in this deep personal element that enters into the poems at times. Turning to another contemporary in this period, Robert Herrick, just a short poem here in which he uses language very effectively in terms of sound in attempting to criticize partly the Puritan regime at this time, which is becoming rather strong and legalistic and critical in its attitude towards society. Herrick was a member of the Royalist and Cavalier Party, was opposed to the growing strength of the government in the age. And the Cavaliers tended more toward looseness, freedom of life and action, the right to live life as they felt they wanted to live without restrictions, whereas the Puritans tended to encourage sound behavior and carefulness in dress and behavior, which they thought was a part of their religious life and the way they were to live on earth, as they thought. Well, Herrick was a cavalier and tended more toward the high church and the Romanist view, which tended to be less concerned about the outward life. Protestantism at this time is very strongly emphasizing life behavior as a means of exhibiting the way in which God wanted man to live at these times. Herrick writes in his short poem, Delight in Disorder, and brings into it some of this satirical voice. A sweet disorder in the dress kindles in clothes a wantonness, a lawn about the shoulders thrown into a fine distraction, an erring lace which here and there enthralls the crimson stomacher, a cuff neglectful, and thereby ribbons to flow confusedly, a winning wave deserving note in a tempestuous petticoat, a careless shoestring in whose tie I see a wild civility, do more bewitch me than when art is too precise in every part. Suggesting in this carelessness of dress an idea of the morality also of the person involved. And the word precise is very interesting here, because often the Puritans were called precisians because of their concern for orderliness of dress. So he selects his word just with this idea in mind at the end, at the clinching point of the writing. You see the comic element too in this, a careless shoestring. It goes to the extreme, to this metaphysical extremity in use of language to create a fresh and original impression upon the reader. Here is one other also playing upon the idea of dress in relationship to the moral character of the individual. Upon Julia's clothes. This seemed to suggest more of a personal feeling of the narrator here toward a Julia figure. Whether there was a Julia or not, at least he uses the name Julia in a number of poems. But it was also a Roman name for a woman well known in classical literature. It could be just using that name because it suits this Renaissance character in the language in England. When as in silks my Julia goes, then methinks how sweetly flows that liquefaction of her clothes. Next, when I cast mine eyes and see that brave vibration each way free, oh, how that glittering taketh me. Responds in the last part with his personal reaction here too, not just the sound or movement of the clothes itself, but the person within the clothes as well he is responding to. So you have these two poems of the cavalier tradition. Counter to that, I'd like to read two short lyrics from the Puritan tradition in the times by George Herbert, one of the fine devotional poets of the 17th century in England. Not necessarily a Puritan at all, but except he in a political sense, but he was not one too concerned about legalism or extreme behavior traits as being so important to life. But he reacts here against the cavalier attitude, or a sort of devil-may-care lack of standard view of life that was common among some of the courtiers in the times. First is the poem, The Collar, dealing with a young lord's, at least it seems, situation and relationship to life. He tends to be bored, he would notice, wanting to find new adventure and the kind of life that will give him pleasure and satisfaction. And Herbert pulls him up abruptly at the end of the poem in a rather interesting way. The Collar. I struck the board and cried, no more, I will abroad. What? Shall I ever sigh and pine? My lines and life are free, free as the road, loose as the wind, as large as store. Shall I be still in suit? Have I no harvest but a thorn to let me blood and not restore what I have lost with cordial fruit? Sure, there was wine before my sighs did try it. There was corn before my tears did drown it. Is the year only lost to me? Have I no bays to crown it? No flowers, no garlands gay, all blasted, all wasted? Not so, my heart. for there is fruit, and thou hast hands. Recover all thy sigh-blown age on double pleasure. Leave thy cold dispute of what is fit and not. Forsake thy cage, thy rope of sands, which petty thoughts have made, and made to thee good cable, to enforce and draw and be thy law, while thou didst wink and wouldst not see. Away, take heed, I will abroad. Call in thy death's head there, tie up thy fears. He that forbears to suit and serve his need deserves his load. But as I raved and grew more fierce and wild at every word, methought I heard one calling, Child, and I replied, My Lord. The next is a short poem, The Pulley, and notice each case of the title of the poem suggests some key concept or relationship, just as man is, in a sense, always collared by the Lordness, and he never gets completely away from God, as he hopes to do in the narrator's view, in the collar, or responsibility in life. In The Pulley, you have an attempt to describe the problem of man's restlessness and boredom in the age as Herbert Lee found it often present, is despite the fact the upper classes had wealth and servants and means and dress and leisure, they were often unhappy in their position, not fully satisfied at heart. And here in The Pulley, Herbert attempts to give a view which might help to explain this restlessness that man is troubled by. The Pulley. When God at first made man, having a glass of blessing standing by, let us, said he, pour on him all we can. Let the world's riches, which dispersed lie, contract into a span. So strength first made a way, then beauty glowed, then wisdom, honor, pleasure. When almost all was out, God made a stay, perceiving that alone of all his treasure rest in the bottom lay. For if I should, said he, bestow this jewel also on my creature, he would adore my gifts instead of me, and rest in nature, not the God of nature. So both should losers be. Yet let him keep the rest, but keep them with repining restlessness. Let him be rich and weary, that at least, if goodness lead him not, yet weariness may toss him to my breast. So restlessness is, as Herbert believes at least, that which finally throws man back to God in his search for pleasure and joy, which he never really finds, being unable to have it without boredom, finally, or disappointment. One of the great poets of the age, at one it's difficult to refer to and give proper value, is John Milton, also a Puritan, writing in the later part of the 17th century. Some of his poems were written just before the Civil War broke out in 1642. Milton's great work is in the long poems, The Paradise Lost, and The Paradise Regained, and The Samson Agonistes. But he did write some short poems, a few sonnets, which show his keenness and ability in the use of language. Just as one sonnet here, written after Milton had lost his eyesight, principally through service to the Puritan government under Cromwell by working as Latin secretary for the English government. And during this time, he was not only just a translator, but he was a key figure and advisor in the Cromwell government during the period of the so-called Protectorate. Even though Milton was not himself so politically minded, but he felt he had to serve, he was called upon by the government, and being one of the great Latin scholars of his time, he seemed to be the man that they could depend on for the post. But he worked hard, staying up late into the evenings, and many feel his blindness partly resulted, at least in time, by his service to the government. And here he is lamenting the fact that now he's lost his eyesight. And how is he now to serve God in the capacity of a blind man, having all of his knowledge and education beyond that of the norm, and having been quite gifted also in writing prior to the Civil War as in the government of the Protectorate. This was published finally some years later in 1673. When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker, and present my true account, lest he returning chide, God doth exact day labor light denied, I fondly ask. But patience, to prevent that murmur, soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. The last line being one of the British used a motto in World War I for the people on the home front who couldn't themselves become involved in the battle itself on the continent, but had to wait out to find out whether their loved ones would or would not be mutilated in some way or killed or injured in the conflict.
What does he mean by that in the context of the poem and his suffering, those who stand in the way?
That we perhaps are egotistic to suppose that God even needs us to serve him. That if we accept God, this is the main thing. And not that we necessarily have to feel we need to serve him to the utmost. He feels that there's some consolation in this situation, at least if we continue to hold to God and believe in him. This would be the basic that we would need. But to survive. Milton is considering himself somewhat of an egotist, at which he was at times, in that many thought him like one of the great knowledgeable men of the century. And he was lamenting the fact that what can he do now as a blind man? He can't write. He felt he did write after this, which is interesting. But this was during a period when he was in the doldrums, despondent with his lot when he wrote this particular poem. And of course, there are those that pride themselves in what they've done for God as the followers of God. And this too he's getting at. Many of the Puritans, of course, tended to consider they were to be considered on the basis of their good works. There was a problem in the Calvinistic Puritanism particularly. So they felt that if we are among the elect, we'll act among the elect and work for God's kingdom on earth as well as in eternity. And because of this view, I think this is why Milton especially stressed this as a counsel to others in terms of his feeling that they must be the righteous, or seem to be the righteous in their actions. That God only requires faith and belief. And of course, not that he's saying we shouldn't act also as Christians in following him, but that at least we need not suppose that God expects more of us. As he's countering the guilt aspect of this kind of Protestantism at that time, where people were haunted by the fact of whether they were among the elect or the damned. At least this is one part of a reading of it. It wouldn't necessarily be the only or the complete understanding of it by any means. One more is short poem here by Richard Lovelace. He was a Cavalier poet with Herrick. And there's some very fun short lyrics, dramatic and emotional during this particular period, without the restraints that were come upon language in the century that was to follow. This is to Althea from prison. When love with unconfined wings hovers within my gates, and my divine Althea brings to whisper at the grates, when I lie tangled in her hair and fettered to her eye, the birds that wanton in the air know no such liberty. When flowing cups run swiftly round with no allaying Thames, our careless heads with roses bound, our hearts with loyal flames. When thirsty grief in wine we steep, when healths and draughts go free, fishes that tipple in the deep know no such liberty. When like committed linnets, I with shriller throat shall sing the sweetness, mercy, majesty, and glories of my King. When I shall voice aloud how good he is, how great should be, and larged winds that curl the flood know no such liberty. Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. Minds innocent and quiet take that for an hermitage. If I have freedom in my love, and in my soul am free, angels alone that soar above enjoy such liberty. Any comments on this free-spiritedness coming especially in love to man, that when he has this, nothing else really can keep him from feeling this inner joy and satisfaction which he has in love. Not too different from the view in Donne's poetry before. So you can't be sure that these are written with much of a personal trust present in them. The next is by a mystic poet of the 17th century, Henry Vaughan, a poet that had written a number of prose writings too, in which he described his relationship with God, a religious mystic. And in his writings, there's one particular poem that's often been considered a classic of the age, the short poem, The World. It brings in some satire here upon the times, criticism of the church, criticism of Puritan statesmen here at a time after Cromwell had taken position as leader of the English government, somewhat of a dictator in the mid-century, a difficult figure to assess because some feel he was a great leader and a great statesman and was the salvation of England in a period when previously the royalism of Charles I, which ended with his death, was leading England to become a weak and ineffective power. Cromwell built up the strength of the British Navy and gave England an important place as a world power in the 17th century. But many people felt Cromwell was a somewhat negative figure too, overbearing, dictatorial, unconcerned especially with the royalty which had been in existence up to this time from the mid-long ages past. Well, Vaughan seems to be somewhat critical of Cromwell's position, refers to him as the darksome statesman in the second stanza. But notice his view to what he feels should be man's concern in life, living the kind of life and following Christ as he felt man should. I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it time in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres like a vast shadow moved, in which the world and all her train were hurled. The doting lover in his quaintest stream did there complain, near him his lute, his fancy and his flights, wit's sour delights, with gloves and knots the silly snares of pleasure, yet his dear treasure all scattered lay while he his eyes did pour upon a flower. The darksome statesman hung with weights and woe, like a thick midnight fog moved there so slow he did not stay nor go. Condemning thoughts like sad eclipses scowl upon his soul, and clouds of crying witnesses without pursued him with one shot. Yet dig the mole, and lest his ways be found worked underground, where he did clutch his prey, but one did see that policy. Churches and altars fed him, perjuries were gnats and flies. It rained about him blood and tears, but he drank them as free. The fearful miser on a heap of rust sat pining all his life there, did scarce trust his own hands with the dust, yet would not place one piece above, but lives in fear of thieves. Thousands there were as frantic as himself, and hugged each one his pelf. The downright epicure placed heaven in sense, and scorned pretense, while others slipped into a wide excess, said little less. The weaker sort slight trivial wares enslave, who think them brave and poor, despised truth, sat counting by their victory. Yet some, who all this while did weep and sing and weep, soared up into the rain, but most would use no wing. O fool, said I, thus to prefer dark night before true light, to live in grots and caves, and hate the day because it shows the way which from this dead and dark abode leads up to God, a way where you might tread the sun and be more bright than he. But as I did their madness so discuss, one whispered thus, this ring the bridegroom did for none provide, but for his bride. Concluding this reference, the belief in the times of that God had prepared a way for those accepting him in the church, the invisible church here of God, so that though these people had the ability, could have if they wanted, reached out for salvation, accepted it from Bond's view, they were failing to do this, at least in the dream, which he saw this. He felt this was the meaning for this, as he saw it. But the ring, this idea of eternity too, is brought out in the ring, referred to in Revelation. And the passages here in Scripture you can see in the King James Version here, very close to reference to some of the lines in the writing. But his conception is a very, very interesting one. Here are just two other short lyrics, one by Sir Walter Raleigh, dealing with life. And this uses the idea of the conceit again very noticeably. Very short. What is our life? Sir Walter Raleigh was quite disillusioned, actually, with the England of his own times, and suffered greatly, finally was imprisoned, and was able to do some writing in prison, wrote a history of the world during that particular time. But he felt very negative to courtiers and to courts, as you'll see in this statement of disillusionment. What is our life? What is our life? A play of passion? Our mirth, the music of division? Our mother's wombs, the tiring houses be, where we are dressed for this short comedy? Heaven, the judicious, sharp spectator is, that sits and marks still who doth act amiss. Our graves that hide us from the searching sun are like drawn curtains when the play is done. Thus march we, playing to our latest rest. Only we die in earnest. That's no jest. Comes to this very strong and negative view here, and a strong view, again, of condemnation of the way in which men were living in the age as he saw it. And speaking very ironically, that this short comedy, a comedy of misfortune, not one in which there is any real good fortune for men. Here's one other short one, then, by George Wither, Shall I Wasting in Despair? This, again, goes back to the love theme concept that a number of the other poets dealt with just previously. Another of these very witty, clever writings of the times, dealing with the idea of love and disappointment when the love is not returned, which the narrator speaks of. Shall I, wasting in despair, die because a woman's fair? Or make pale my cheeks with care, cause another's rosy are? Be she fairer than the day, or the flowery meads in May, if she be not so to me, what care I how fair she be? Should my heart be grieved or pine, cause I see a woman kind, or a well-disposed nature joined with a lovely feature, be she meeker, kinder than turtle dove or pelican, if she be not so to me, what care I how kind she be? Shall a woman's virtues move me to perish for her love, or her well-deserving known make me quite forget mine own? Be she with that goodness blessed, which may gain her name the best, if she be not such to me, what care I how good she be? Cause her fortune seems too high, shall I play the fool and die? Those that bear a noble mind, where they want of riches find, think what with them they would do, that without them dare to woo. And unless that mind I see, what care I, though great she be? Great or good or kind or fair, I will ne'er the more despair. If she love me, this believe, I will die ere she shall grieve. If she slight me when I woo, I can scorn and let her go. For if she be not for me, what care I for whom she be? You get this clever twist and play upon relationships here in a rather cleverly balanced and fashioned way within the poem. But you can see in the age this versatility and wit and cleverness and language in which all of the poets at the time tended to vie with each other in being clever about certain standard themes, sometimes though speaking very personally as Donne does or as Milton does in that sonnet I read, but generally speaking the poets were strongly affected by the Renaissance spirit of which required that they be clever and use language beautifully. So you have a great deal of outstanding poetry from the period of about 1550 through to about the time of the Civil War in England in 1642. Some of the great dramatic literature, of course, in poetry comes during the same age. And there are many who say, well, we've never had an age quite like that of the 17th century, that all poetry beyond that time really looks rather weak in comparison as far as cleverness of language and lyricism is concerned. On the other hand, you don't get some of the personally motivated poetry you get in the 19th century, nor do you get quite the keenness in the use of certain technical aspects of poetry you encounter in the 18th. But for the time at least, with the language in a state of flux, the poetry of this English Renaissance is certainly one of the great periods to go back to. And I just sampled some of the poetry, but depending on what type of poetry you yourself are interested in, you'll find that, especially in lyric poetry, in poetry of sound and beauty of language, this was one of the really great periods of all. Poetry was the media of literature. No short story, no novel to compete with poetry. You had the epics, but they're the epics of the past. There were no successful epics written in the age. You had a few lengthy poems, finally, with Milton's Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. But generally speaking, the best work is in the shorter lyric works and in dramatic poetry in the plays. But it's a very a rich period as far as language is concerned. The poets had the right to wrench language, to make verbs out of nouns, nouns out of verb patterns. They could borrow from other languages if they felt the need to make a word or manufacture a word to suit their needs. So sometimes the language is a little confusing, but these poems I don't think contain too many ideas of complexity, but there are other writers who did use some expressions. They're a little hard to get to without the aid of footnotes. Fortunately, most of your present-day editions of poetry this time are well annotated and documented so that these things are made clear. Did you have any comments or questions to make about these poems or any throughout.
Just one thing, to what extent was the poetry of the Enlightenment, like with Alexander Pope, that was a return to sort of the classicism, wasn't it? That sort of.
With emphasis on the rules, which were established in the period of the 17th century in France. These rules were passed on then to England through some of the critics, and it rather fixed the character of the approach to subject matter, especially the Roman ideas of Horace, and affected then the spirit of English poetry. Here in the Renaissance, really, there's a classical spirit that influenced it, but it's a much more free period, and there hasn't yet been the character of extreme stress on technique that comes to it with Pope, and the need for writing about the whole of society rather than oneself within it. So you shift from somewhat personal tone in the Renaissance period to a sense of writing for the whole of society, not in one's own person. So more restraints come upon the way of using language. It's still a very interesting period, but it doesn't appeal quite as completely to the modern reader as it would have to people of that time.
Would the Romantic poets were rebelling against?
Yes,
they put the style of whatever it is right. And it seemed like in the 19th century the whole movement, even politically, was against that. People trying to get their rights.
Even in politics, shift, though it doesn't go very far really to bring about any real equality.
Yeah.
They wanted at least individuality, whereas in the 18th century the attitude often was to accept the situation of the times, especially when England felt it was reached a high point. They felt the English society is superior to that of France and Italy. Why should we borrow from them? We have another great civilization like the Romans had when Horace was writing his criticism. So it's another golden age, they felt, in England. They were quite proud of the point at which they'd reached as a society, as a people. So they didn't mind, you see, being associated with the state or with the wise people of their times. They felt people tended to generally agree about what was good taste and what was good writing and what subjects even they should write upon. But nevertheless, it's very outstanding in terms of the perfection of line and perfection of certain forms of poetry. I was going to go on to that next time, turn to the 18th century to follow up. So in the three sessions, I'll at least throw out some ideas regarding the changes in the spirit which influenced literature is through to the 19th century. In the Renaissance, you have the period of so-called discovery in England, a strong interest in developing a national spirit under Elizabeth's court, and a tendency to display outward and dress and beauty and pay a lot of attention to it, because the court wanted to become an admired court of Europe. And the courtiers dressed, when they spend a great deal of money on their dress. So there's reason for, even some of Shakespeare's sonnets are quite critical of the great amount of money spent by men on dress. The actors, for example, spent for their costume as much as a month's wages for one suit of clothes. You can imagine how fine and expensive it was in terms of their particular times. This was almost expected of them in their age. And this outward finery, of course, just hit the Puritans very negatively, just as outward expense today is criticized by people whose money could be spent more wisely for other purposes. And of course, the royalists had the money and the wealth and the place, and so that the Puritans often were those who were rising in business and were somewhat envious, too, of the wealth which the upper classes had, or the hangers-on even of that class who supported them. But the language sort of goes along with the dress, you see, this beauty of show and expression. This was to equal the exterior glamour of the society itself. And the courtier was expected to be able to ride and to sing and to write poetry, to be trained in arms so he could serve his country when he was called. Supposed to be very interested in the arts in general and in conversation. The Baldassare Castiglione's The Courtier had emphasized in Italian literature in the 16th century, which became the handbook really for the English society in translation in the Renaissance period. Of course, many writers had reservations about this and criticized, like Shakespeare did, at the same time that he went along with it to some extent too in some of his comedies. So you get a really mixed situation in the writings. You get the negative feeling of Raleigh, for example, against that spirit very strongly. He being one of the courtiers who had been cast off by Elizabeth. And so he was willing to respond, feeling that he had nothing to lose. He saw the writing on the wall that he was going to be imprisoned and mistreated by the new regime. Are there any other questions you might have? Well, I guess it's getting on too.
Very good.
Well, if you have any questions, be sure to bring them up.